Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Mandatory. That's how one Wall Street observer characterized the need for a cut in interest rates. Got to fix that liquidity problem. But there's only one guy who can really say whether it's mandatory, and he's not talking until tomorrow. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Bantam Books, publisher of Super Crunchers, Why Thinking by Numbers is the New Way to Be Smart, by Ian Ayers. More at supercrunchers.com. And by Bank of America, through community outreach, philanthropic giving, and environmental efforts, finding opportunity and embracing it. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity, bankofamerica.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Thursday. It's the 30th day of August. Will he or won't he? That's the question as Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke gets ready to speak at an annual monetary conference in Jackson Hole, Wyoming tomorrow. Just about everybody who is anybody in the financial world is waiting to see if he gives any indication, anything, of a possible cut in interest rates. There's been so much speculation about it that investors seem to be assuming a rate cut is in the offing. So what if it's not? For some analysis, we turn to Michael Sheldon of the investment banking firm Spencer Clark. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
There is a lot of talk right now that a rate cut is already priced into the market, that everyone is expecting this to come, and that's what's influencing trading right now. Would you agree with that?
I think that's certainly true. There are a couple different possibilities. Right now, the markets, as you mentioned, are pricing in, I guess, the hope or the possibility that the Fed will cut rates by a half or a quarter point at their next FOMC meeting on September 18th. But there are two potential outcomes. One, if the Fed doesn't cut rates, how disappointed will the markets be? And I think they'll be fairly disappointed. But then there's another alternative, which is if they do cut the short-term lending rate by a half or a quarter point, what if the markets don't rally or respond from that? Hmm. What will that say about the markets and the economy?
And what do you think it would say?
Well, I think that would be a pretty negative scenario because it would probably indicate that the underlying problems in financial markets or the economy are probably a bigger issue than the Fed can solve with just a short-term rate cut.
Are you in the camp that says they need to lower rates?
I think the Fed needs to lower rates by at least a quarter point, one that would start to instill a little bit of confidence that the Fed is doing the right thing. They don't have their head in the sand. It's not going to be like the Greenspan Fed where there's a sort of the old Greenspan put and they come to the market's rescue. But I think investors want to know that the Fed will be there to provide stability and liquidity when needed.
Well, everybody's kind of waiting to see what Chairman Bernanke says tomorrow in Jackson Hole and that maybe that'll give some indication one way or another. How do people like you go about kind of getting a bead on the Bernanke psyche after so many years of Greenspan? How are they different?
I think they're different in a couple of ways. One is, as you said, we're so used to Greenspan, who was there from, I think, 1987 through last year.
Mm-hmm.
And Greenspan's approach to monetary policy was certainly, he watched all the data, and he talked about a lot of esoteric data points, but I think the way he changed policy was somewhat more instinctive in that he wanted to sort of get out ahead of problems. He sort of had a feel for when the markets were going to have problems, when the economy might suffer from a particular issue. I think the Bernanke Fed is a little more schooled in economic history. Bernanke himself is a big student of the Great Depression. He understands what the Fed did wrong at that point. I think he's going more by the textbook as opposed to Greenspan, who is a little more instinctive.
Well, given what you just said about Bernanke's interest in history, what role is history going to play in how he plays this out?
Well, there are a number of different issues. I guess, you know, if you look back at the Great Depression, there was a problem in the money supply, and the Fed didn't do enough, although they lowered rates, they didn't do enough to supply enough liquidity to the banks, and the banks then couldn't lend, and everyone started foreclosing on their houses, and industrial production started declining because there wasn't enough liquidity to lend to corporations. So the Bernanke Fed, I think, wants to make sure that the banks are well supplied and there's enough liquidity in the economy.
Michael Sheldon, thanks so much for your insight.
Thank you very much.
Michael is a chief market strategist for Spencer Clark and joined us from his office in New York. The Army is launching a major investigation into reports of waste and fraud in all those private contracts awarded for military operations in Iraq. A task force of 90 people is now supposed to examine every contract handed out by the military's contracting office in Kuwait between 2003 and 2007. 4 years, 18,000 contracts. That task force is going to be busy. Here's Marketplace's John Dimsdale.
The military's contracting with private companies for services in Iraq and Afghanistan has been plagued by reports of no-bid sweetheart deals, inflated prices, lost or stolen equipment and weapons, and kickbacks. The task force's target, the contracting office in Kuwait, disbursed $3 billion for military support services over the past 4 years. David Mulholland looked into the Kuwait-based contracts when he was business editor for Jane's Defense Weekly. He alleges the Pentagon was using the contracts to reward powerful Kuwaiti allies.
Some of it, I have pretty good reason to believe that it was directed corruption from the Bush administration to essentially grease the palms of high-ranking Kuwaiti officials. Some of it just pure corporate greed and corruption. Some of it just pure incompetence. My guess would be is that it's a combination of all three.
The Pentagon already has a special inspector general to look into corruption in Iraqi reconstruction contracts. But attorney Sam Gadansky, a former Defense Department assistant counsel, is one of many who've been frustrated trying to bring cases of fraud to the inspector's attention.
Unless you present an absolute black and white case to the special inspector general's office, they say they don't have the resources to handle the situation.
Gadansky welcomes the Army's commitment of 90 staffers to review the Kuwaiti contracts. The Army is also centralizing its contracting operations. By January, all contracts worth more than $1 million will be handled in the U.S. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
All right. You know how cool it is when you find just the right song to be the soundtrack to that YouTube video you made of your cat? Well, guess what? Somebody wrote and recorded that song that you used in your video. Today, YouTube announced a music-sharing agreement with thousands of UK songwriters. They'll get paid when their music shows up on the video-sharing site. But a similar deal with U.S. content providers is still a long way off. Janet Babin reports from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
The music licensing agreement is between YouTube and a European alliance that represents 50,000 UK songwriters. According to the Financial Times, YouTube will pay the group a flat fee for any of their songs that show up on its site, even if the music's just the background of a homemade video. The alliance then distributes the money. James McQuivey with Forrester Research says YouTube's parent company, Google, hopes this deal proves it respects big U.S. content owners.
The real purpose here is that YouTube wants to show that they mean to be a good corporate citizen and play along with everybody else.
But that's not the takeaway for Proskauer Rose attorney Lou Solomon.
We're not impressed. It's sort of half a loaf. It's half a loaf Google style.
Solomon represents content providers that are suing YouTube over copyright infringement, including the National Music Publishers Association. He says it should be up to content providers to decide if they want to be on YouTube in the first place. Now you have to negotiate when your content's already up on the site.
YouTube and Google are taking their property or allowing it to be taken without any compensation. Of course, they're negotiating with a gun to their head.
YouTube has maintained that the law, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, puts the burden on copyright holders to prove they've been infringed upon. But the company has made some interim agreements with smaller content providers. And this summer, YouTube announced it would start using filtering technology to catch copyrighted shows and music. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
The seesaw that is Wall Street thumped back onto the dirt today. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Been feeling the need to pop a Dramamine every time you watch the stock market these days?
Well, that's how it's supposed to be, right? I mean, the market goes up and then down and then back up. It's got cycles and phases and seems to right itself over time. Nothing we can really do, so just live with it, right? Wrong, says commentator Amity Schles.
We tend to think of market movements as weather, something you enjoy or endure but can't do much about. After all, people born in 1960 or later have seen mostly blue sky in their trading lives. To them, it has all felt like good weather. They know nothing of periods like the 1930s. Then it seemed like Katrina all the time. But crashes and recoveries aren't inevitable like weather. Sure, there are business cycles, but there are also consequences to actions by administrations, Congress, central bankers, and foreign governments. That was true in 29. Then bad policy, abroad and here, made a crash into something worse. Herbert Hoover signed a protectionist tariff even though he knew better. More than 1,000 economists wrote a petition begging him not to, but he still did. Hoover also raised taxes in a downturn. Bad. He and everyone else got the monetary policy wrong. They thought deflation was inflation and acted accordingly. Ouch. Roosevelt said his famous phrase, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." But even FDR caused some fear. Again, through bad policy. Several New Deal programs were based on crazy ideas, like that the time the shopper spent choosing his chicken at the market slowed recovery. FDR spent year after year prosecuting business stars who were not criminals. Andrew Mellon and Samuel Insull. No one knew who would be next. The uncertainty kept the Dow low through the decade. Bad policy can trigger a downturn now, too. Protectionism for China haters. Really high taxes in the name of budget balancing. The kind Congress plans to talk about this September. Superfluous prosecution. The recent crash at least reminds us that it matters what Washington does. On Wall Street, observers are updating Roosevelt's rule. They have a new phrase. The only thing we have to fear is the lack of fear itself.
Amity Schles is the author of a new book on the Great Depression called The Forgotten Man. What's your take on market psychology? Let us know at marketplace.org. Click on Contact. Regular watchers of CNBC may have noticed a few changes lately. Maybe the graphics seem a little splashier, the anchors and commentators a little more jazzed up. It's no accident. CNBC is gearing up for the arrival of a new kid in town. Fox is launching its own business channel in mid-October. And as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, the fight is already getting ugly.
The trading floor at BMO Capital Markets is typical. Traders hunch over Bloomberg and Reuters terminals. Squawk boxes broadcast the hum from other trading floors around the globe. And the flat-screen TVs overhead are almost always tuned to one channel, CNBC.
That's the real danger.
But as of October 15th, Owen Lynch expects that to change. He's BMO's head of equities trading in the U.S., and he plans to make room for Fox's new business channel.
You can count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 televisions in this trading room. My guess is, you know, we'll probably go 50-50.
Statements like that have got to make CNBC executives' blood run cold. The network is one of parent company NBC Universal's most profitable units. It made more than $300 million last year, according to research firm SNL Kagan. SNL analyst Derek Bain says because CNBC is a near monopoly, it can charge advertisers premium rates and cable operators top license fees. Bain says when Fox offers those operators an alternative, CNBC will lose some of its leverage.
It's not like, you know, next year the bottom is going to fall out. But I think as these contracts come up for renewal, you know, it's unlikely that they would get any kind of an increase in excess of maybe inflation.
The official line from CNBC is bring on the competition. The network is rolling out the big guns. A new ad campaign features prominent CEOs like Mel Karmazan of Sirius Satellite Radio.
I am American business. I watch CNBC.
One CNBC staffer who didn't want to be named says these days every decision at the network is made with Fox in mind. Porter Bibb invests in media companies at the private bank MediaTek Capital Partners. He says those decisions include spicing up the programming.
They're doing a lot of girding of the loins.
Which family controls the Washington Post company?
They've got MBA challenges using the best business schools in the country, competing against each other in a financial quiz show.
What do you got?
Graham family?
That is correct. Yale 3600.
You got Jim Cramer with his flamboyant style of stock picks.
You know how bottoms got caused.
They are trying to broaden the content and the presentation, and to a certain extent, it's working.
Some viewers might even say CNBC is starting to look a bit like Fox News. Brian Stelter is former editor of industry blog TVNewser.com. He's now with the New York Times.
They definitely are reading from the Fox playbook in some ways. They've seen they can increase their ratings, especially among younger viewers, by having more personality and having more emotion in their coverage. And I think they'll continue doing that.
Some worry that the big loser in the ratings battle might be the journalism. On one hand, the networks will inevitably compete to break stories and score the best interviews. But Fox has indicated it may be less aggressive than CNBC in chasing down stories that might put companies in a bad light. And as CNBC aims to appeal to a wider audience, equities trader Owen Lynch says he's found the network less useful as a news source. With Fox parent company News Corp set to own the Wall Street Journal, Lynch hopes the new channel will target serious investors like himself.
My hope is that it's a little less gimmicky.
That may be wishful thinking. This is Rupert Murdoch we're talking about, owner of tabloids like Britain's Sun newspaper and the New York Post. And a more staid business channel already exists. Bloomberg Television reaches about 40 million U.S. subscribers. That's less than half CNBC's reach. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up, the legacy of Diana lingers, but at what price?
They used to call her the Princess of Sales. If you put a picture of her on the front cover, you could get up to 25% increase.
But first, let's do the numbers. All it took was a few financial firms saying the credit crunch might affect profits, and markets soured fast. The Dow fell 50 points today, about a third of a percent, and at 13,238. The only bright spot, if you really want to reach, was the NASDAQ. The tech-heavy index tacked on, 2 points and closed virtually flat at 2565. The S&P shaved off 6 points, 0.4%, and at 1457. Lehman Brothers chopped earnings estimates for four Wall Street banks. Goldman Sachs fell 1.3%. Merrill Lynch trimmed off almost as much, around 1.25%. Morgan Stanley, 1.7%. Bear Stearns, 0.33%. And Merrill Lynch also recommended that investors sell Walmart stock. And so Walmart stepped down nearly 2%. Bonds gained. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.5%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Friday. The Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for July. Blue Planet runners arrive in D.C. on day 92 of their global run to raise awareness of the need for safe drinking water around the world. And a service in London marks the 10-year anniversary of the death of Princess Diana. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. That groan you heard emanating from L.A. last night, that was soccer fans wondering what's next for bad news David Beckham. The superstar footballer injured his right knee in an international game with the Los Angeles Galaxy. As Bex himself said, it's just gone from one thing to another thing. So we've got David Carter on the line to talk about what's going on with one of the highest paid athletes in all of sports. He is the founder of the Sports Business Group. Welcome back to the program.
Good to be here.
So now, obviously, David Beckham could heal from this injury and get better and play all of the rest of the games that he's committed to for the MLS. But for the time being, how do you think MLS and Galaxy fans are feeling at this point, given that he's played, what, half a game in total?
It hasn't been a whole lot of quality time yet. And I think you have to really break it down into two different scenarios. There's the casual fan who I think really feels slighted. These are the fans that bought their tickets under a certain set of expectations, but are receiving something quite different. And although there's no guarantee when you buy a ticket that you're going to be able to see a specific player, I think the level of disappointment is now at a national level, as it's likely that he's going to continue to miss some additional road games. Now, that's sort of the first part of it. The second bucket is those international fans. They're really the sports aficionados that might be here in this country. And my guess is that they might be a little less surprised by this. And in fact, they may not have been spending as much on Beckham as that casual family of four, the ones that might be playing youth soccer in this country, for example.
Put yourself in the front office for a minute, either at the Galaxy or at MLS headquarters. And are they concerned at this point? Have they already essentially reaped everything that they were hoping for from him?
Well, I think those might be two different issues. I think it's indisputable that Adidas, the Galaxy, Major League Soccer, even sponsors like Herbalife that have come online, have done quite well. I think you could probably argue very strenuously that they have received their return on investment. However, there is ill will being created, as we've talked about, among fans who have purchased tickets with the expectation of seeing him. So, you know, I think it's going to come down to how do they manage expectations the rest of the way? Are people going to want to continue to invest their time and hard-earned money, not knowing if he's going to be playing, not just for the next few weeks, but what does it mean for the next year or two when he continues to get older and if his travel schedule continues to be as intense? How likely will it be that he's going to continue to be hamstrung by injuries?
David, what about the league itself, Major League Soccer? He could come back, as we've mentioned, but if he's not the active player that everyone expected him to be, what does that mean for the league?
You know, it may not be that devastating. I think that David Beckham can get those casual fans to the front door. He can get them to the turnstile. It's ultimately going to be up to MLS to service those people, to make sure they have a safe and affordable time at the game. And in fact, they walk out of there thinking to themselves that attending an MLS game is as strong a source of entertainment as anything else we could have done. And so, you know, he can be the Pied Piper in terms of getting them to the turnstile. But then I think it really is about overall quality of the experience that will get these fans coming back.
David Carter is the executive director of the Sports Business Institute at the University of Southern California. Thanks for chatting this over with us.
Thank you very much.
It's one of those events that often prompts the question, do you remember where you were when you heard the news? We'd just gotten home from a cross-country trip when my husband turned on the TV and yelped, "Diana's dead." From another room, I retorted, "Yeah, right, that's not funny." Tomorrow marks the 10th anniversary of the death of Diana, Princess of Wales. Politicians, pop stars, and royalty from around the world are descending on London for memorial events. But despite the media hoopla, a decade on, interest in the princess has waned. And along with it, the businesses that grew up around her image. Our Stephen Beard has more from London.
A handful of tourists have gathered outside the gates of Kensington Palace, Diana's last official residence. They read the dozen or so written messages of sympathy and look at the few bunches of flowers that are pinned to the railings. Most of the visitors have clearly not come here to mark a solemn anniversary.
I didn't even know about it. Is her birthday today?
It's the 10th anniversary of her death.
No, I didn't know about it.
Yeah, I think I'll have a few moments of thinking about her and
But 10 years is gone and we haven't forgotten it, but you know, you get on with life.
I'm not really into the whole monarchy of England.
She's not the reason you came to visit England?
No, definitely not. Just by luck that we are here right now.
A hard core of Diana devotees will be in mourning tomorrow, but generally the mood in the capital is markedly different today from what it was on August the 31st, 10 years ago.
This is BBC Radio News from London. Buckingham Palace has announced the death of Diana, Princess of Wales.
The news triggered some extraordinary scenes in Britain. A country famous for its phlegmatism suddenly fell apart.
Oh, God! Oh, my God!
The British tabloid press was equally bereft, says author and academic Chris Horry, not because a secular saint had died, but because they'd lost a valuable asset.
They used to call her the Princess of Sales. If you put a picture of her on the front cover, you could get up to 25% increase, especially in the more downmarket women's magazines.
So great was her pulling power in the summer of 97 that a tabloid paid more than $1 million for a grainy, unfocused picture of her apparently embracing her beau, Dodi Fayed. Today, how things are different.
She's now really a bit of a niche product. She's not going to sell many newspapers, and even scandal and tittle-tattle about her, which comes out from time to time from her former employees, it doesn't make anything like the impact it once did.
The waning interest is obvious here on London's Oxford Street. Souvenir shops used to shift vast quantities of Diana cups, plates, T-shirts and fridge magnets. Now you find hardly any. One shopkeeper told me he had a Diana spoon, but after rummaging through his stock, he produced a utensil carrying a picture of Camilla Parker Bowles. That's Prince Charles's former mistress and now wife. The Diana Memorial Fund used to fight tooth and nail in court over the use of Diana's image. But, says manager Astrid Bonfield, it's now phasing out its licensing of souvenirs.
We're not a fundraising organisation, and in that sense, the commercial licensing programme will in fact cease completely next year. It's almost entirely wound down now.
Thousands of tourists flock to Britain because of Diana, according to the travel guide, The Lonely Planet. In a final irony, they go to see the royal palaces because she raised the profile of the British monarchy. While at loggerheads with the House of Windsor, says Lonely Planet, Diana has ensured that thousands more paying visitors enrich the coffers at Buckingham Palace. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified mix of international investments can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, Apple aficionados, don't freak out yet. These are just rumors. But we can confirm that Apple CEO Steve Jobs met with Volkswagen chief Martin Winterkorn. And there is reportedly some talk of an iCar. If you wearied of the press surrounding the iPhone's release, brace yourself. If these whisperings turn out to be true, there is no telling what might happen next. Anybody for an iDog? Maybe an iHouse? iVey. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 50 points, 0.3%. The Nasdaq gained 2 points, basically flat. The S&P 500 lost 6 points, 0.4%. Our editors include John Buckley, Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, and Lisa Tucker. Next time on the program, Vietnam rolls out the welcome wagon.
The message from them, they want to open up. They just step forward, big step forward, to accept the Vietnamese overseas, especially Vietnamese American.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Join us again tomorrow.
American Public Media.